This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
An electronic odyssey for this month's KBOO night at the Clinton Street Theater. The documentary tells the story of Leon Theremin, his invention of the only instrument you play without touching it, and its use in Hollywood films and rock music. The film will be showing 7 p.m. Thursday night, July 11th, at the Clinton Street Theater, corner of Southeast 26th and Clinton, and all proceeds will benefit
KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report alleges that between 2006 and 2010, the California State Prison System illegally coerced nearly 150 female inmates into undergoing permanent sterilization.
A violent attack on a secondary school in the state of Yobe, Nigeria, leaves 42 children and teachers dead Sunday afternoon.
And the bill regulating medical marijuana dispensaries in the state of Oregon passes the House of Representatives and heads to the governor for his signature. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 8, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Serena Fong. Opponents of the Columbia River crossing are celebrating what they see as a victory last week when the project was declared dead. Some organizers are already looking forward to the next steps and have organized an event in Vancouver this Thursday. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Sharon Nassett of Third Bridge Now.
What were some of the things that your group discovered about the Columbia River crossing project and the way that it was being governed?
Originally, the first 18 meetings that they had of the Sponsors Council, which are elected officials that make the decisions on the purpose and need and the framework, were all held in secret and broke Oregon and Washington open meeting laws. Many of the open meeting law violations also happened with meetings that took on the different groups, the Environmental Justice Group. The Oregon Environmental Justice Group was formed and then disbanded three different times because the staff which handpicked them couldn't get them to make the decisions they wanted. And they did the same on the Washington side, and then there were other hidden meetings, millions of dollars that have been squandered and spent, and then false, inaccurate data, old data. The list is very, very large. Right now they have $20 million in receipts missing from those events where they said they were going out to citizens' meetings for coffees and events in the parking. $20 million that they have not one receipt for besides the other meetings they said they did have.
And the project so far has cost close to $200 million. I wonder if you think that's money that has been wasted or has anything come out of it that will be useful going forward?
I think it is going to be close to 200. You're correct. They've been reporting 170, but it's not all in. 80% of the data can be reused. The data is information that people look at in a different manner than what the CRC looked at it. It's all reusable. The only thing is it's time sensitive. The federal government gives you a 10-year window on data. So we need to turn around immediately and do a supplement using that data so we don't lose the value of it, and then go forward going for federal funding, because we still have a supplement is usually 6 months to 18 months. So we still have the time frame and the window frame to get something accomplished, and we lose almost $1 billion a year to congestion here in Portland.
What are the main alternatives to the Columbia River crossing? We've heard about the Common Sense Alternative and your group, Third Bridge Now. Have there been any cost analyses with these alternative bridge proposals?
Both of them were removed before the Columbia River crossing did a benefit and analysis on what it would do for freight costs and impacts on the community. So unfortunately, they were removed. There are only so many ways that you can cross the river, and it is basically from I-205 to I-5, there really isn't a place to do a crossing, and the traffic doesn't want to go there. From I-5 west, there is next to the Burlington Northern Rail, which has been identified since the original rail was put in there in 1906 as the location for another bridge. So then it's basically decided whether you want something like the Common Sense Alternative, which is more land-based in arterials, or if you want to do something like what the Third Bridge is, which is a freeway that removes the freight and traffic from the neighborhoods and actually is looking for something that won't be full immediately. And then Cascadia focuses mostly on heavy rail, but they have an alternative too.
Again, I've been speaking with Sharon Nassett with Third Bridge Now, their website, thirdbridgenow.com. The event coming up this Thursday, July 11th, 4:30 to 9 p.m. at the Academy, 400 East Evergreen Boulevard in Vancouver, called Alternative River Crossings. Let's Get Started Now. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Longshore workers across the West Coast protested work conditions today, with some workers occupying offices of management and temporarily shutting down ports. In Portland, workers protested downtown and briefly took over the office of the grain terminal owners. KBOO's Jamie Partridge was there and brings us this report.
Let's stand. Let's stand. We're peaceful. Are we a peaceful protest? Are we doing something wrong?
No.
Are you scared, Brother Guard?
No!
Yeah. Essentially, one of the dispatchers showed me they essentially shut down the harbor in Los Angeles. 900 jobs went down to our casual hall. Our casuals did take jobs, but they were turning them away with one and goes, two and goes. They couldn't fill the work. They did consolidate some cranes to get some ships out or whatever, but the word verbatim is we essentially shut down the harbor. LA, Long Beach, LA, Long Beach. So, look, you're not alone.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
So this protest is like no other demonstration I've ever been to. There's no spokespeople, there's no bullhorn, there's no chants, there's no speeches. But there are 100 longshore active and retirees and their supporters crowded into the lobby of the one main place, the building where the Pacific Maritime Association employers' office is being protested, protesting the delays and denial of medical coverage for retirees. The police, the Portland police, are here, and the security guards are here, but they're not even attempting to move the crowd out of the lobby. The word from the Pacific Maritime Association is that they are charging the union with an illegal work stoppage. An arbitration will be happening this morning. If the fact that some container ships were unable to be filled this morning is declared illegal, then the employer can deny continuation benefits when there is no work. But apparently it's worth the while for these for this longshore union to go forward with an illegal work stoppage to protest the denial of medical benefits to their retirees.
That was KBOO's Jamie Partridge covering the protests by local international longshore and warehouse union members of the Pacific Maritime Association's handling of insurance claims by active and retired union members.
Today marked the last day of the Oregon State Legislature. Senators and representatives worked through the weekend to get several bills passed and wrapped up business this afternoon. One bill that would have automatically registered Oregon voters failed on a 14-16 vote in the Senate. The bill, introduced by the House Rules Committee and carried by Representative Lou Frederick, would have automatically enrolled eligible residents to vote. Using driver license information, the Secretary of State's office would have automatically enrolled individuals, then sent out a postcard allowing constituents to opt out. Democrats claim the bill would have helped individuals overcome barriers that exist in the current voter registration system. The bill passed the House on a largely party line vote, with all but three Democrats voting yes and all but one Republican voting no. The bill would have passed on a straight party line vote in the Senate, but opposition from Democratic Senator Betsy Johnson prevented the bill from going to the governor. Senator Johnson feels that it should be the responsibility of the voter to make sure they are registered. Democratic Senate Majority Leader Dianne Rosenbaum changed her vote to a no in an attempt to bring the bill back up at a later date.
They're bargaining with the state of Oregon again today.
But some state government workers will take a vote on Tuesday that could authorize a strike, just in case their standoff goes unresolved. Contracts for about 19,000 workers in a variety of human service jobs have expired, from people who issue driver's licenses to those who investigate child abuse. The two sides are reportedly close on pay issues, but workers are concerned about the state hiring contractors and chipping away at health care benefits. Jill Sipes, who works for the DHS in Klamath Falls, says they're willing to keep bargaining.
Even if we authorize the contract team to go on strike, we are still open to negotiations with the state, absolutely. We do not want to impact our communities, you know, not serving them. We definitely want to be on the job.
The workers are members of the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, Local 503. And to the heckler at their information picketing event, who called her and her fellow workers parasites, Sipe says it's best to shrug it off. She says most people interact with state government and know that workers provide many necessary services, from home care for seniors to qualifying low-income families for benefits.
We're serving over 7,000 families with food stamps in this town. We've got over 260 children that we're dealing with in child welfare. I guarantee I'll find somebody in their family tree or a friend that they dearly care for that have worked with a state worker at one point in their life.
Sipe says many make incomes low enough that they would qualify for state or federal benefits. She adds, with unpaid furlough days and the state freezing their pay steps or periodic raises in recent years, they feel they've done plenty to help balance the tight state budget. Bargaining continues today in Salem. For KBOO News in association with the Oregon News Service, I'm Casey Decker.
Five protesters were arrested during a July 3rd occupation of the Portland-based Matheson Air Cargo Facility. The protesters, calling themselves Postal Protectors, are part of a larger group who have staged a number of protests against postal closures across Oregon. A recent closure at the Salem processing plant moved operations to Portland. Due to a lack of space at the Portland Postal Facility, the sorting machinery from Salem is being housed in a private space nearby. That space is owned by the Matheson organization, who hired 12 non-union workers to run the facility. The group's chief organizer, Jamie Partridge, sees this as a move towards increased privatization of the U.S. Postal Service. These closures are in part due to budget cuts stemming from the high cost of retiree health benefits. According to supporters, the United States Postal Service is being forced to spend close to 10% of its budget to finance benefits out 75 years. In a press release, Patriot states that, quote, no other U.S. agency or private business face such a crushing financial burden. Congressman Peter DeFazio has been very vocal on this issue. On his website, DeFazio blames United States Postal Service bureaucrats for offering short-sighted solutions. A bill that regulates medical marijuana dispensaries in Oregon passed the House of Representatives on Saturday and now goes to the governor for his signature. The vote was mostly along party lines, with all the House Republicans voting against it. The bill creates a registry for businesses that want to legally sell medical marijuana and does not apply to recreational drug use. The fees to register will pay for the costs of managing the registry. Existing medical marijuana dispensaries will now have to be registered in a state database. The bill also states that such establishments can only be in a farm or commercial area and must be 1,000 feet away from schools or other facilities. In addition, the Oregon Health Authority will be able to perform inspections of all facilities registered under this bill. Before the bill, medical marijuana had patients grow their own marijuana or find someone to grow it for them. Currently, there are about 55,000 medical marijuana patients in Oregon.
Oregon landlords will soon lose the ability to explicitly exclude renters who use federal rent assistance vouchers. In a bill approved by the Oregon Senate today, landlords will no longer be able to turn away prospective renters who receive Section 8 housing vouchers. The bill's sponsor, House Speaker Tina Kotek, said the widespread practice is discriminatory. The Senate narrowly passed the bill with a 16-13 vote, one day after deadlocking on the bill with a 15-15 vote. Last-minute negotiations between the parties led to the bill's passage in today's last legislative session. With the signature of Governor John Kitzhaber, the new law will prohibit landlords from stating that Section 8 recipients need not apply to vacancy listings. Landlords, however, would be able to discriminate on the basis of other financial factors. An investigation last year by the Oregonian found that discrimination against voucher users meant that those receiving Section 8 had little opportunity to live outside of low-income neighborhoods. The study also found that Section 8 use has ballooned in low-income neighborhoods east of 82nd Avenue.
The National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, said today that Asiana Flight 214 was flying much slower than recommended when it crash-landed at the San Francisco International Airport on Saturday. The 777 from Seoul was flying at around 125 miles per hour as it approached the runway. The recommended airspeed approaches almost about 160. According to Reuters, the flight voice recorder showed no signs of distress until 7 seconds before impact, when the crew tried to accelerate in a last-minute effort to correct the landing. The crash, which killed two people and hospitalized another 182, is still under current investigation by the NTSB.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news after this newscast, followed by Labor Radio discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, connecting with the community inside. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow is expected to be another sunny day, with highs near 85 degrees. Tuesday night should see increasing clouds throughout the evening, lows around 59.
It's currently 5:16, and that means it's time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
A few years ago, during consideration of a bill being pushed by a Republican elder in the Texas Senate, first-term Senator Wendy Davis asked him a question about it. Rather than respond to this Democrat, this woman, the old bull replied dismissively, "I have trouble hearing women's voices." No more. Even a stone-deaf old bull would have been jerked to attention by the clarity of Senator Davis's voice on June 25th. For more than 11 grueling hours, she literally stood tall, filibustering a mean and demeaning attempt by extremist Republican leaders to put the state government in charge of the most personal right of women, controlling the decisions about their own bodies. Davis's principled stand, in Texas no less, rallied over 2,000 mothers, grandmothers, girls, and others to come to the Capitol from all over the state, packing the gallery in quiet witness. Quiet until 10:04 p.m. That is when GOP leaders tried to silence her by unilaterally ruling her filibuster over. Suddenly, the ruling Solons were startled by a high-decibel reprimand from their subjects. The gallery erupted in citizen outrage, causing chaos on the floor. Then, when the leaders tried to force a vote, the followers took charge, with jeers so loud that senators couldn't hear themselves. With the session set to expire at midnight, panicky leaders tried to push the clock back, which led to deafening chants of shame, 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 ultimately blocking the GOP's brutish ploy. This is Jim Hightower saying Texas Republicans have already re-rigged the rules so they can get their way on another day, but they can't escape the huge significance of this defeat. As Senator Davis rightfully noted, while she was the one standing on the floor, it was the people's filibuster that stopped the bill, and that has awakened a new movement in Texas that won't be stopped.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A new report alleges that doctors under contract with the California State Prison System illegally sterilized nearly 150 female inmates between 2006 and 2010. A review of state documents revealed that the sterilizations were done without state approval and often against the will of the inmates. Some of the women who have been sterilized say that doctors pressured them to do so while they were restrained and sedated. Others claim they were not provided with complete information about sterilization or were made to feel that they were bad mothers if they did not get the procedure done. Doctors allegedly targeted women that they believe, quote, already had too many children. In a report by the Center for Investigative Reporting, The doctors performing the procedures said they were only conducting them in cases of, quote, medical emergencies. Forced sterilization of institutionalized persons has been illegal in California since 1979. Medical care in California's prisons has been under the supervision of a receiver since 2006, when a judge ruled that medical care in California's prisons was tantamount to unconstitutional, cruel, and unusual punishment.
Prisoners being held at the Pelican Bay plan to initiate a second hunger strike beginning today, mirroring a demonstration launched in 2011. None of the demands have been met, as the policy of indefinite detention as solitary confinement, which continues as of this day. Alexei Angelklithos, a staff attorney for the Center of Constitutional Rights, spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about the suit in the organization filed against the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation over the conditions at Pelican Bay.
I'm talking with Alexei. He's a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Can you tell me how the original incident in 2011 began?
California is unique in terms of its rampant use of solitary confinement for shocking periods of time. Basically, its prolonged isolation of thousands of men is without equal in the United States. There's just no other state in the country that's consistently retaining so many people in solitary confinement for such lengthy periods of time. Conditions at Pelican Bay are exceedingly harsh. The way in which prisoners are sent to and kept at Pelican Bay is also egregious. You can be sent there and retained there for years upon years based simply on flimsy evidence of gang association rather than any specific acts of gang-related misconduct. After years and years and years of living under these conditions and being subject to these policies, these guys just organized themselves in order to draw attention to what was happening to them. They're so isolated, so cut off from the world, that they really just felt that this was the only way they could shine a light on what was happening to them. And they were incredibly successful in doing so. You know, thousands of prisoners engaged in the hunger strike in 2011 in solidarity with the prisoners at Pelican Bay. And I think the world really learned what was going on at Pelican Bay. And unfortunately, not much has changed there in the couple of years that have passed since that hunger strike. And so the prisoners at Pelican Bay have had to resort to another hunger strike in order to protest the conditions under which they're living.
How many of their original core demands were met?
Well, unfortunately, the prisoners' core demands have not been met in any meaningful way, and it's more or less business as usual at Pelican Bay. It's true that CDCR has circulated a proposal that purports a pilot program that purports to allow gang-validated prisoners to earn their way out of the SHU by completing a multi-year step-down program. But there's no real indication of how one does that. First of all, the pilot program is explicitly temporary, so it expires by its own terms in October of 2014. Second of all, not a single one of our clients has yet experienced any change in his situation or any review as a result of this pilot program. And most fundamentally, the pilot program appears to continue to allow prisoners to both be sent to and retained at the SHU based simply on allegations of gang affiliation that rather than any specific acts of gang-related misconduct.
Just for clarification's sake and our listeners, SHU stands for Secured Housing Unit?
That's correct.
And it's little more than a tiny concrete box?
That's right. It's a very small cell, no window, completely made of concrete. There is a metal door with small perforations in it with a slot through which meals are delivered. And the men at Pelican Bay are just languishing in this cell for at least 22 and a half hours a day, oftentimes 24 hours a day. They're allowed to leave their cell three times a week to take a shower. So they never have any exposure to natural light. They never have any normal face-to-face interaction with another human being. It's very, very chilling to contemplate. The Center for Constitutional Rights, along with our partners in California, have brought a federal civil rights lawsuit on behalf of prisoners who have been incarcerated in the Pelican Bay SHU for these unconscionably long periods of time without meaningful review of their placement.
This is Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Rapper and actor Mos Def has recorded himself being force-fed as part of a protest against the force-feeding of Guantanamo Bay prisoners on hunger strike. Mos Def, who now goes by the name Yasin Bey, produced the graphic clip for the human rights organization Reprieve. The video shows the rapper wearing a jumpsuit and strapped to a chair while a feeding tube is inserted into his nostril. Here's a clip of the video. Just a note of caution, it is disturbing to listen to and to watch.
Stop it, please! Stop! I really didn't know what to expect. And then the tube went in, and the first part of it is not that bad, but then you get this burning. I got this burning. And then it just gets to, starts to be like really unbearable. It feels like something's going in, there's something was going into my brain, and it started to reach to the back of my throat. And I really couldn't take it.
That was rapper Yasin Bey, formerly known as Mos Def. More than 40 of the 100 hunger strikers in Guantanamo Bay are being force-fed using a procedure similar to the one depicted in this video. The strikers are protesting treatment violating international human rights law, as well as the perceived failure of the Obama administration to close the prison facility and release cleared prisoners. The issue of force-feeding is gaining attention as the Muslim holy month of Ramadan approaches. Starting this evening, most Muslims will not consume any food during daylight hours, until Ramadan ends on August 7th. The Obama administration has stated that force-feeding during Ramadan will take place exclusively at night to avoid violating religious customs. But lawyers for the prisoners say that government lawyers have remained, quote, silent as to how they might implement nighttime-only force-feeding. Pentagon spokesman told CNN this week that doing so is an accommodation, not a right.
In Sao Paulo, Brazil, this morning, the local government launched a nationwide investigation into whether the Brazilian-operated telecommunications firms located there cooperated with the U.S. as part of a spying program that has collected data on billions of telephone and email interactions. The O Global newspaper reported this weekend that information released by NSA leaker Edward Snowden showed Brazil as the top target in Latin America for the NSA's intelligence-gathering efforts. The article stated that the NSA collected the information through an association between unspecified U.S. and Brazilian telecommunications companies. Communications Minister Paulo Bernardo told the reporters he, quote, has no doubt whatsoever that Brazilian citizens and institutions were spied upon. The report did not specify the type of data collected, but the programs appear to gather what is called metadata, logs of message times, addresses, and other information, rather than the actual content of the messages. Journalist Glenn Greenwald, who originally broke the Snowden story, said he leaked documents also suggest that the U.S. was using Brazil as a bridge to collect data on other protected states whose traffic is not directly accessible but may pass through Brazil.
Classified rulings by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, also known as FISA, have broadened the National Security Agency's ability to collect data on Americans. The rulings now permit the NSA to collect data on people suspected of committing terrorism, nuclear proliferation, espionage, and cyber attacks. One of the most significant changes was a court ruling that found the NSA's practice of gathering Americans' communication data does not contradict the Fourth Amendment requirement of a warrant for searches and seizures. U.S. intelligence agents must only be suspicious that American communications contain, quote, foreign intelligence.
A violent attack Sunday afternoon on a secondary school in the state of Yobe, Nigeria, has left 42 children and teachers dead. Boko Haram, an Islamic extremist group based in northeast Nigeria, forced students and teachers into a closed room, threw explosives at them, and then set the building on fire. In response to the attack, Yobe Governor Ibrahim Gadim had closed all secondary schools until the fall semester. The state suffers frequent attacks by Boko Haram and has been under a declared state of an emergency since last May.
A researcher at the Center for Naval Analysis claims that drone missile strikes are 10 times more deadly to Afghan civilians than manned aircraft strikes, according to the UK news source The Guardian. The researcher, Larry Lewis, studied United States airstrikes in Afghanistan from 2010 to 2011. Lewis's fellow researcher, Sarah Holinsky, says a possible cause for this discrepancy between drone strikes and manned strikes is the training on civilian protection that fighter pilots receive, which aids them in lowering the civilian casualty rate. Authorized data regarding drone strikes is classified, but officials in the Obama administration have cited the accuracy of drones. However, an advisor to the United Nations says drone accuracy may be overstated. According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, the rate of civilian violence in drone strikes has decreased since 2010 from an average of just over 11 casualties per strike to nearly 4 casualties per strike in 2013. However, a drone strike in Pakistan on Wednesday had the highest casualty count since October 2010, killing between 16 and 18 people.
And now we go to the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for June 29th to July 5th, 2013. The Palestinian new prime minister focused this week on the deteriorating economy, and the Israeli army attacks leave one Palestinian killed and five others injured this week. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report as usual with the nonviolent activities organized in the West Bank. This week, protests were organized in the villages of Al-Nabi Saleh, Bil'in, and Ni'lin in central West Bank, in addition to Al-Ma'sara in the southern West Bank. IMEMC's Salam Kumsiya reports.
At the villages of Bil'in and Ni'lin, residents and their international and Israeli supporters managed to reach the wall. Soldiers stationed there fired tear gas and chemical water on protesters. Many civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Meanwhile, at the nearby village of Al-Nabi Saleh, Israeli soldiers attacked the villagers and their supporters before leaving the village. Soldiers used tear gas and chemical water against unarmed protesters. Later, troops invaded the village and fired tear gas into residents' homes. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Elsewhere, at Al-Ma'sara village, Israeli troops stopped the villagers and their supporters at the village entrance and then forced them back using rubber butts and buttons to push people back. No injuries were reported. For IMEMC News, this is Salam Kumsini.
The new Palestinian prime minister in the West Bank says his first priority is to fix economical problems. Meanwhile, no new prospect for resumption of peace talks between Israel and Palestinians. From Gaza, IMEMC's Ram El-Mighari has more.
As Palestinian Authority continues to face financial difficulties amidst stalled peace process, Palestinian Prime Minister Rami Alhamdulillah said this week that he will focus attention on sorting out economic problems. This week, United States Secretary of State John Kerry failed to bring back Palestinians and Israelis to the negotiations table, as he could not secure Israeli halt of illegal Israeli settlements construction. Kerry still hopes certain progress could be achieved if the parties concerned are willing to restart peace talks. Palestinians want Israel to stop all those constructions so that talks could be resumed. In the meantime, Palestinians in Gaza hope recent change of the Egyptian regime would not overshadow Palestinian-Egyptian relations negatively. Palestinian Prime Minister of Hamas Ismail Haniya downplayed the removal of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi of Egypt, saying that Egypt remains the closest country to Palestine and the Palestinian people. For IMEMC News, I'm Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, the Israeli army conducted at least 65 military invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank and Gaza. During these attacks, Israeli troops killed one civilian, injured five others, and kidnapped at least 64 Palestinian civilians. IMEMC's Iman Abid Rabbo with the details.
This week, Israeli army invasions were concentrated in the cities of Jenin, Ramallah, Hebron, and Bethlehem. Two invasions this week were also reported in the Gaza Strip. Among those kidnapped by the army from the West Bank this week were six children and Palestinian lawmaker Mohammed Abu Tayr. On Monday, Israeli soldiers killed 19-year-old Mu'taz Sharawne during an invasion targeting the town of Dura near Hebron City in southern West Bank. Soldiers shot Sharawne, then drove over him with their jeep. Troops claimed he tried to climb on the jeep. His nephew Baha, 22, sustained a bullet wound while trying to rescue his uncle. Sharawne, a student at a Palestinian security college in Jericho, is the ninth Palestinian to be killed by the army during West Bank invasions since the beginning of the year. On Wednesday morning, clashes erupted between Israeli troops and local youth at the town of Abu Dis near Jerusalem in central West Bank. Israeli troops stormed the town and searched homes, then clashed with the local youth, local sources reported. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. On Thursday, clashes erupted between local youth and invading Israeli troops at Al-Jalazon refugee camp, east of the central West Bank city of Ramallah. No injuries were reported. In the Gaza Strip this week, Israeli forces continued to attack fishermen at sea. On Wednesday, Israeli gunboats stationed off northern Gaza Strip coastline opened fire at Palestinian fishing boats that were sailing in the allowed 6 nautical miles offshore. As a result, one fisherman was likely wounded. For IMEMC News, this is Iman Abdrabbo.
And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine. This was the weekly report for June 29th to July 5th, 2013, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Pate, Dan Torres, Yosie Lichten, John Rasmussen, Mike Clefford, Daisy Casey Deckler, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Serena Fong. Our engineer is Danielle Parks, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenkins Odeberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number of Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, host Abe Pronter and Joe Uris discussed Edward Snowden and the modern America security state.
At 9 on Alternative Radio, Professor Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, speaks on Incarceration Nation. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
And at 11 on stage and studio, host D. May Roberts hosts a special hour-long edition on the Summer Shakespeare Festival. We'll hear about Portland's Shakespeare Project's Taming of the Shrew, and then we'll travel to Ashland for a talk with actress Neil Gastlinger, who's performing a sizzling rocker, Katarina, in Oregon Shakespeare Festival's Taming of the Shrew. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support of community radio. If you're not yet a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, John.
Good night, Serena.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 8th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. In Istanbul, a park that's been the center of nationwide protests was briefly reopened today before riot police moved in, dispersed the crowd, and then closed it again. Gezi Park had been slated for demolition for commercial development, but has since become a symbol for anti-government protesters who complain about rising authoritarianism in Turkey. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
Taksim Square in Istanbul was eerily quiet Monday evening after riot police evicted people from nearby Gezi Park and sealed off the area. Earlier today, Istanbul's governor had reopened the park to great fanfare after a court ruled against plans to raise it for commercial development. Rafat Magriso, a 30-year-old restaurant owner, says he and his friends were among those kicked out of the park.
Of course, people have different opinion, of course, and this is very regular. But one thing, this violence needs to stop.
Over the weekend, thousands of demonstrators had tried to force their way into the park before being repelled by riot police using tear gas and water cannons. Public anger was then further stoked after an Istanbul court released four machete-wielding men who had attacked protesters on Saturday. As dusk settles today, further clashes are expected as Turkey moves into the Ramadan season. Tensions remain high between an uncompromising government and a mass movement determined to reclaim public space. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Those are the headlines for FSRN from Tampa, Florida. I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Egypt, supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi and military officials offered conflicting reports of what took place early this morning when more than 50 civilians were killed and hundreds more injured at a protest in front of military headquarters in Cairo. Video posted online by activists shows injured and bloodied protesters fleeing the scene. Some hold bullet casings and wear red-stained shirts. Photos show bodies lined on the floor of a hospital morgue in Nasser City, some with bandages or tape across their foreheads. Witnesses said soldiers fired on a crowd outside the military facility as they held a sit-in to demand the release of Morsi. The health ministry said 51 people were killed, more than 300 injured. The military said some of the crowd was armed and fired on soldiers first, an account the Muslim Brotherhood disputes. Interim President Adli Mansour ordered a judicial committee to investigate the incident. Meanwhile, the crackdown on media continues. Al Jazeera said that its Cairo bureau chief was taken into custody over the weekend and interrogated, then charged with transmitting news that could compromise Egypt's national security. Several TV channels backed by the Muslim Brotherhood were raided last week. For more, we're joined by Ahmed Shook. He's an activist and writer. He's been following the events from Cairo and talking with people in the streets. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
More than 50 killed, hundreds more injured outside the Republican Guard headquarters in Cairo. The details of exactly what happened still to be confirmed. What has the climate been like in Cairo since the early morning attack?
Well, the climate is very tense. The military and the interior ministry, backed by most of the media in Egypt, are trying really hard to present the narrative that this was done in self-defense. And my sense talking to people in Cairo this morning is that their narrative is succeeding. Now, on the other side, the Muslim Brotherhood gave a statement earlier today calling for an uprising in Egypt. And, you know, this could set off a chain of events, you know, that gets very violent and that can get out of hand very easily. So the mood is very tense. There are still a couple of other sit-ins being held around Cairo by pro-Morsi supporters that have been completely encircled by the military, by armored personnel vehicles. And so we'll see towards the end of the night if anything else develops. But as it stands, the events of today have been very worrying.
much of the coverage we're seeing in the U.S. is focused on these powerful institutions we're talking about, either the military, the Muslim Brotherhood. What about grassroots groups, groups like Tamarod, which originally began the petition drive and called for people to come out into the streets on June 30th? Are there smaller groups or grassroots groups that are calling for nonviolence or other kinds of change at this point?
Yeah, it's important to keep in mind that the events in Egypt over the last week were precipitated by an outpouring of public anger beginning on June 30th by millions of ordinary people on the streets who, you know, came out in the millions to express a very wide range of grievances. And the dominant feeling for all the people on the streets, whether their grievances were social and economic in nature, whether they were political, was that that Mohamed Morsi was, not a leader for all Egyptians. He was the leader of a self-interested clique, the Muslim Brotherhood, and that he was ruling in a manner that aimed at consolidating his organization on power, not on building a true democratic order. The latest example, Tamarod, has taken on a size and has operated on a scale that's larger than any other grassroots campaign I know of in Egypt over the last 2 years. But I think it's still a long way to go, before the kind of grassroots opposition that we saw on June 30th can begin to articulate itself through, forms of political organization that can really bring sustained pressure to bear on those in power and engage in politics in a different way.
Ahmed Shook is an activist and writer. He joined us from Cairo to discuss the latest developments in Egypt. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
A top privacy advocacy group is seeking to halt part of the U.S. government's sweeping surveillance programs. The Electronic Privacy Information Center submitted an emergency petition to the U.S. Supreme Court today, asking it to prevent the National Security Agency from collecting any more U.S. phone records. As public interest groups take action against the mass collection of domestic data, legal experts and heads of state are raising concerns about the U.S. government's international surveillance practices. Three Latin American presidents have announced their opposition to these practices and offered asylum to the man.